A young man of refined appearance, but evidently suffering great mental distress, presented himself one morning at the residence of a singular old man, who was known as a surgeon of remarkable skill. The house was a queer and primitive brick affair, entirely out of date, and tolerable only in the decayed part of the city in which it stood. It was large, gloomy, and dark, and had long corridors and dismal rooms, and it was absurdly large for the small family, man and wife, that occupied it. The house described, the man is portrayed, but not the woman. He could be agreeable on occasion, but for all that, he was but animated mystery. His wife was weak, wan, reticent, evidently miserable, and possibly living a life of dread or horror, perhaps witness of repulsive things, subject of anxieties, and victim of fear and tyranny. But there is a great deal of guessing in these assumptions. He was about 65 years of age, and she about 40. He was lean, tall, and bald, with thin, smooth-shaven face and very keen eyes, kept always at home, and was slovenly. The man was strong, the woman weak. He dominated. She suffered.
HPPodcraft.com.
That was the opening of a tale called The Monster Maker.
Shake your monster maker like somebody about to pay ya. You know I got it if you want to come get it. Stand next to this monster like, hey, hey, hey.
That's pretty good.
Was I on my own on that one?
Is that a pop song of some kind?
Monster Maker, yeah.
Okay. The Monster Maker is by author W.C. Morrow, an author who has only a real tenuous connection to Lovecraft.
A tenebrous connection, even.
And that's why we're talking about this story here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
We are at hppodcraft.com. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey.
And our reader today is the lovely and talented Jeff C. Carter of the Venice Jeff C. Carters. Jeff is an excellent writer of fictions, weird and otherwise. You can check out his work at Great Jones Street. We will link out to it in the show notes. Yeah. He's got some of his fiction up there. Good stories. Of note, I would recommend to our listeners, there's a story up there called With Their Eyes All Aglow. It's a Christmas story. It's got spiders.
Right.
Yeah. Basically, the two conditions necessary for great literature.
Right, there you go.
It's one of the essential conflicts. It's man versus man versus nature, Christmas versus spiders. With the three originals one, so it's in that fine tradition. Please go over to Great Jones Street. Check that out. As I said, we'll link out. Thanks, Jeff, for reading for us today.
We've never talked about W.C. Morrow, so here's a bit of bio on the fella. He was born in 1854 to a Baptist minister and owner of a farm and a hotel in Mobile, Alabama. His family lost all of their slaves. Aww. Too bad for them. In 1876, and the young Morrow was running a hotel by the time he graduated Howard College, which is in Birmingham, and he was 15 years old. He moved to California in 1879 and began selling short stories to the Arconaut, where Ambrose Bierce had just quit a two-year period of employment. Bierce was an enthusiast of Morrow's stories, and in 1887, he probably recommended to William Randolph Hearst to approach Morrow so that he would write for the San Francisco Examiner. Several of Morrow's most notable tales appeared in this newspaper.
We should note that you're getting this bio from S.T. Joshi's book, The Evolution of the Weird Tale.
That is correct.
There's an essay in there titled W.C. Morrow, Horror in San Francisco. So if folks are interested in further reading, that's a good source to check out.
Morrow married Lydia Houghton in 1881. They had one child, but the child died in birth or when it was very young. His first novel, Blood Money, it came out in 1882, and it was about the Muscle Slough tragedy that was sort of an indictment of the conduct of the California railway companies that were forcing people settling on that land to get off of their land. The book didn't do very well for Morrow, but it was kind of strange because a few years down the road, he ended up actually becoming a public relations guy for the Southern Pacific Railway. So, that's a little strange.
But, he needed a job because the book didn't do very well. So his indictment wasn't quite, didn't have quite a sear on it like it needed to have.
I guess not. He wrote another novel, A Strange Confession, and that was serialized in The Californian in 1880 to 1881. His stories were collected in The Ape, The Idiot, and Other People in 1897. He published a few stories after that. By 1899, Morrow had begun a school for writers and produced a pamphlet called The Art of Writing for Publication. Bierce had kind of a strange comment on that. He says, "It is a pity Morrow teaches others to write badly instead of himself writing well. But I fancy we have no grievance therein, or if we have it, is against the pig public, not against Morrow. He would write books, doubtless, if he could afford to, as I would do."
It's the pig public's fault for not buying more of his work.
Yeah.
That he has to teach, you know, people who are probably bad writers.
Morrow published two romantic adventure novels, A Man, His Mark, in 1900, and Lentala of the South Seas in 1908.
Joshi also co-edited an anthology of Morrow's work called The Monster Maker and Other Stories. So that's a current edition of his short stories that you could pick up.
Yeah.
The title story is The Monster Maker, which is what we're covering today. So let's dig in.
Into the story, we don't get anybody's name in this. We have a young guy who's coming to an old guy and wife's creepy house. The old guy's a surgeon of great skill, but people hear things about this guy, so they just stay away.
You know, so Bierce in that quote, he's saying, you know, he's teaching others to write badly instead of himself writing well. Bierce is saying that he writes well. I kind of disagree about that. I felt like this whole story, and this is all I've read, but I felt like this whole story had a sort of clumsy quality to it. It definitely was Bierce-like in a lot of respects.
Sure.
But he doesn't pull it off as well. There was just a kind of... There was an awkwardness in that first paragraph that we heard, actually, which threw me.
Mm-hmm.
The sentence says, "The house described, the man is portrayed, but not the woman." Then the next sentence, "He could be agreeable on occasion." What? I thought you just said you were going to describe the woman. Then he moves on and says, "His wife was weak, wan, reticent." I had to go back and read those three sentences a number of times to get the intonation right.
Sure.
He was comparing the two, first starting with the husband, but it was poor writing because it completely tripped me.
Yeah.
Right there in the opening paragraph. And it, maybe I'm just picky, but I felt like this happened quite a bit where he had clumsy terms of phrase that made me had to reread so that I could understand the action of the story. And that's by definition bad writing, in my opinion.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I didn't find myself getting caught up on that. I got a little bored like about halfway through. This young guy has come to the door and wants to chat. He seems a little off his nut. Maybe he's manic depressive. Is how the surgeon kind of sizes him up.
Right. And now the surgeon, you say that people have heard things, so stay away.
Yeah.
They probably just concocted some exaggerations because he lives in a giant scary house, but it also says he likes to experiment in vivisection, which I guess is the thing that puts people off.
Right.
Vivisection is, of course, cutting an animal open while it's still alive, seeing what's going on in there. Mm-hmm. I was wondering already, how do people even know that he does that?
Yeah.
I mean, apparently he's got a practice. You know, this young man shows up so you can go to his house and get checked out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible maybe he brought it up during a patient visit. Otherwise, I don't see it, you know? Do you have a history of high blood pressure? Any allergies? Do you care if I slice open this parrot and watch its heartbeat? Something like that.
Yeah.
You know, slipped out maybe.
Maybe, yeah, he was doing vivisections while examining other people.
Put this thermometer in your mouth, and as long as it takes for me to cut this calf open, that's how long it's supposed to stay in there.
He pulls the young man quickly into his house. It's dark. It's old. It has lots of doors that are locked, kind of partitioning off different parts of the house. So he has to kind of open a door and then unlock another door to go into another room. And
right.
He sits the young guy in front of an open window. So the guy's facing out. So I guess probably because it's got natural light so he can look at him. And he begins to examine him.
Right, but that window shows out on nothing. I think it shows out on another wall.
Yeah.
About 6 feet from the house. So it is that kind of house of secrets where everything's a little covered and blocked off.
The young man, he says he's just given up and pulls out $5,000. Mm-hmm. He says that he will give him all of his money. This is all the money he's got if he helps him. And the surgeon asks, well, okay, what do you want me to do? And the young man leans in and whispers in his ear.
This reminds me of a similar interaction I know about. Mm-hmm. This is way back in the day, like 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
A friend of mine was driving by the Davenport Levee at night. And there's lots of interesting characters used to hang around there in the evenings. And mm-hmm. this well-known local doctor came up and tapped on his window. And my friend rolled it down and the doctor said, $50, I you, you me, I
Whoa!
It was kind of a surprising offer.
Yeah.
So I guess it reminds me of this in that there was an offer, it was surprising, and then there's a doctor involved. but we don't know what the young man wants for that $5,000. Hopefully not the same thing that Dr. wanted.
So at this offer, the old guy jerks back, very angry, and then he tells him, I do not want your money. You are simply foolish. You think you're in trouble? Well, you do not know what trouble is. Your only trouble is that you have no trace of manhood in your nature. You are merely insane. You should surrender yourself to the authorities and be sent to a lunatic asylum for proper treatment. The young man spits back. You old dog, you insult me thus. Grand airs these you give yourself. Virtuously indignant old murderer you. Don't want my money, eh? When a man comes to you himself and wants it done, you fly into a passion and spurn his money, but let the enemy of him come and pay you, and you're only too willing. That's interesting. He's got this reputation of actually killing people.
Yeah, at this point, I kind of figured out that it was euthanasia. So is he saying that people pay the doctor to put other people to death? I couldn't figure out if that was some nonsense he was leveling at him because he's angry or if that was actually true.
It might not be true. It might just be what people are saying about it.
But he's got that reputation.
So the young man, he just kind of freaks out and just gets more and more upset about it. And the surgeon just tells him to sit down. And he seems to be thinking this over. His words had some impact on him. Mm-hmm. You were thinking that this was euthanasia at this point.
I wasn't actually 100% sure, but when he says you'll do this to people, I was like, what could it be? I suspected it, but I didn't know for sure at this point.
Being that the story was called The Monster Maker, I was hoping that it was turn people into monsters.
Me too. I thought he was like, can you do this for me? I got $5,000. Give me, you know, I want to look like this muscle thing.
Right. Or I want to have gills so I can breathe underwater, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. It's not. The surgeon asks the young man a bunch of questions about himself and his family. And then he says, does anyone know that you came to this house? And he says, no. He goes, will your prolonged absence cause any alarm or people to look for you? And he goes, nope, I've prepared for that. And he goes, I wrote a note that said I planned on drowning myself in the river. The guy goes, well, they'll drag the river. And he goes, so what? And they won't find anything. Things flow in the river. Rapid undercurrent, you know.
A lot of the time they search for bodies and they just don't find them because they moved along.
He asks the young man if he's ready, and the man is excited. He says yes, as if he's in line for Space Mountain or something. He really wants to be euthanized, I'm assuming.
He says he wants extreme anesthesia.
Right.
Which could also be a ride. Climb on board the extreme anesthesia.
Or drag queen, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
The surgeon asks if there's any last words or messages. He has none. He says, no, only nullification, simply a blowing out as if a candle in the wind, a puff, then darkness without a trace.
Yeah, he's really happily resolved to this fate.
The surgeon gets up and listens at the door, and then he opens it and he goes and opens up another door. Mm-hmm. Then he has him follow him. They go into a lab of sorts with a sofa that's under a skylight. He has the young man lie down on the sofa. The surgeon asks if he has any heart problems, and the young man says no. But then he goes, well, wait, why do you care if you're killing me if I have a heart problem? And the old man just says, well, I just want to make sure it's as painless as possible. And, you know, at this point, I was very positive it was suicide.
But this is also the first indication that the doctor might be up to something.
Yes.
You know, there was a decision that the doctor made earlier. It was remarked upon. He suddenly went, It was right before he started asking him, is anybody going to find you? Does anybody know where you're at? Something happened in his head. And right here, he's like, yeah, sure. I don't want you in any pain. That's the ticket. You know, something else is going on.
So he makes up a drink and he asks the man again if he's sure he really wants to do this. And the young man is excitedly ready. So he hands the young man a drink and he downs it. And then the young man says, thank you. You are the noblest man that lives. May you always prosper and be happy. You are my benefactor, my liberator. Bless you, bless you. You reach down from your seat of the gods and lift me up into the glorious peace and rest. I love you. I love you with all my heart.
Wait a minute. I've changed my mind.
He takes the young man's pulse and asks how long it will take. The surgeon says 10 minutes, 8 minutes are left. The surgeon starts to say past hearing and blind. And the young man says, doctor, doctor. And he goes, and numb, doctor. And then he's out. So he starts talking to himself. He says things like, this is the first step, and I could be killed for what I'm doing. But science!
He says, I've waited 40 years for an opportunity like this. So he knows that whatever he's about to do with this young man, even if it's successful, he can't tell anybody about it or he'll be hung, which is why maybe he hasn't tried it yet in those 40 years. But this bozo showed up, basically said, do whatever you want with me and nobody will know. So the temptation is far too great to execute on whatever this plan is he thinks will get him hung.
He then wonders if his wife had heard anything.
Right. Remember, we have this wife, and as the story was established, he keeps his wife under his thumb. We suspect that maybe she's beaten or scared. Mm-hmm. He is a tall, bald, bad husband. He's got to make sure that she doesn't know about the stuff that he's up to.
Yeah. So he goes in and checks on her, and he says that he heard someone in the house, but he can't find anybody. And she says, oh, I didn't hear anything. But she did hear a knock at the door. And he goes, oh, yeah, I didn't let them come in. And then she goes, but I did hear some shoes and you're wearing slippers. So who was that? And then he goes, oh, no, I had my shoes on earlier. And then I took them off and put on the slippers. And she goes, oh, okay.
Riveting. Hitchcock himself could never have concocted such suspense.
I was still into it, man.
I guess you know, they do this whole scene to set up that she's around and she can witness whatever it is he's about to do.
Right. So he goes back and he checks on the young man and has a mad scientist moment. He's splendid specimen. Every organ sound, every function perfect. Fine, large frame, well-shaped muscles, strong and sinewy. Capable of wonderful development if given opportunity. I have no doubt it can be done. I could go on. This goes on for a long time.
Yeah.
But he talks about the brain and how the cerebrum is where the intellect and affections are stored, and the cerebellum is where all the senses and motor functions are. Mm-hmm. And that he is going to do away with the cerebrum.
Which I don't understand. He's done this with a dog, so he knows he can do it. The dog was able to retain its physical senses, was able to move around to be an animal, but with the cerebrum removed, it was an idiotic dog. We heard a bell, didn't do anything. That's how stupid it was. So he's interested in making a creature that can move but doesn't think? This seems like an odd project to get on board with, but...
Sure, why not? He's a mad scientist, dude.
He's excited about it.
He says, paid me $5,000 to kill him. Don't have the courage to snuff out his own candle. Allow me to inform you, sir, that you are as much alive at this moment as ever you were in your life. But it will be all the same to you. You shall never be more conscious than you are now. Basically says he's going to do the same thing to him. He's going to take out part of his brain.
Yeah, maybe not even just his brain, because at the end he says, by the way, how should you feel without a head? Ha ha ha. But that's a sorry joke. Okay, I guess he's going to remove his head and see if he still works.
So it's just going to be a headless guy.
Interesting. Is this all building up to a Halloween prank? We'll find out.
We skip ahead 3 years and we have a new scene. It's the captain of the police talking with a detective. They're having a conversation about a woman who came into them. It's the old woman, about something she saw in her house.
The wife, you mean?
Yeah.
And I think this story was turn of the century.
Yeah.
But man, this dialogue reeks of 1950s Ed Wood stilted B-movie crap. You have to read some of this with me.
I will.
You read the captain. I'll be the detective.
Okay. She may be insane.
I think she is.
And yet you credit her story?
I do.
Singular!
You have heard those queer stories of her husband. Well, they are all nonsensical, probably with one exception. He is generally a harmless old fellow, but peculiar. He has performed some wonderful surgical operations. The people in his neighborhood are ignorant, and they fear him, and wish to be rid of him. Hence, they tell a great many lies about him, and they come to believe their own stories. The one important thing that I have learned is that he is almost insanely enthusiastic on the subject of surgery, especially experimental surgery. And with an enthusiast, there is hardly such a thing as a scruple. It's one of my favorite lines. With an enthusiast, there is hardly such a thing as a scruple. It is this that gives me confidence in the woman's story.
You say she appeared to be frightened?
Doubly so. First, she feared that her husband would learn of her betrayal of him. Second, the discovery itself had terrified her.
But her report of this discovery is very vague. He conceals everything from her. She's merely guessing.
In part, yes. In other part, no. That's my favorite line in the whole. Oh, man.
I have to admit, at this point of the story, I lost interest.
It's so bad, and I know it's fiction, so maybe the dialogue's not as important, but who would say anything?
I don't know.
First, she feared that her husband would learn. Second, the discovery itself had terrified her. That is so Ed Wood to me. It's like an approximation of what you think humans might say, but not quite getting there. Anyway, they're talking about the wife, and apparently she's been seeing some creepy stuff over the last 3 years that have elapsed.
She saw something so horrible, she won't even describe it. She describes one of the rooms as having been reinforced with bars and windows, and she tells about how her husband has been taking away a lot of food and eating it on his own.
Like way too much food. Case of Charles Dexter Ward level.
Right.
Too much meat being imported.
The captain thinks that it could be animals, but the setup isn't really for animals. It's something that you would build for people. Mm-hmm. The captain suggests that maybe the old surgeon is keeping a lunatic in his home for some kind of treatment. But the woman heard no voice, just some loud banging.
Right, and nobody else has been informed that a lunatic was transferred to the creepy old house unit for treatment. There's nothing in the medical community to confirm this theory, so it's definitely not a lunatic. And this all leads the detective down a very frightening path of realization. Let's get a little more of that sweet, sweet dialogue.
Have you any suspicions?
I have.
Of what?
A crime. The woman suspects it.
And betrays it?
Certainly, because it is so horrible that her humanity revolts. So terrible that her whole nature demands of her that she hand over the criminal to the law. So frightful that she is in mortal terror. So awful that it has shaken her mind.
What do you propose to do?
Secure evidence. I may need help.
You shall have all the men you require. Go ahead, but be careful. You are on dangerous ground. You would be a mere plaything in the hands of that man.
What does that mean? That is the most Ed Wood thing ever. All they know is that he's a surgeon.
Yeah.
Why does he say that? You would be a mere plaything in the hands of that man. What?
That's ridiculous. Yeah, it's terrible. So 2 days later, the detective talks to the captain again. He has a document that the old woman stole from her husband. It's got a lot of evasive techno talk, but some of the bits that stood out to me were his talking about wishing to have started on a younger subject, like an infancy, but his results are really good, better than he expected.
Yeah, he's basically conducting some kind of experiment to see if the body's nerves can act all on their own without a brain. And so he's pondering what works and what doesn't. But it's mostly nonsense in that paragraph. Of course, he does write, "Nor am I surprised that such prodigious muscular energy is developing. It promises yet to surpass the wildest dreams of human strength." Whatever his experiment, of course, he somehow just made it extremely dangerous.
As you do.
And this journal entry has a lot of nonsense in it that I don't think I would take the time to puzzle it out if I had the time to do it. It was just so boring. But the gist is that the thing he's working with, and obviously we know that it's the guy from the beginning that wanted to commit suicide. This young fella is now in some kind of altered state, is extremely strong, and has a voracious appetite.
Yeah, it says, "By some means, while I was absent, it unscrewed the stopper of the silver feeding pipe, which I have already herein termed the artificial mouth, and in one of its curious antics, allowed all of the child to escape from its stomach through the tube. Its hunger then became intense. I may say furious."
I didn't really have a picture of what this was in my head yet, though, so this whole silver feeding pipe, artificial mouth thing didn't make sense to me.
To me, it was really creepy.
I agree with you
there. And gross. Yeah, I was like, what the heck is going on here? Mm-hmm. And then I got interested again.
Yeah.
It also goes on to talk about how his muscles on the subject are getting stronger and stronger.
Rereading it on this pass, it's obvious to me what was happening. But I was still a little puzzled on my first read of this at this point.
Yeah, I was too. They still don't understand what's going on, the detective and the captain, so they decide to raid the old surgeon's house. At 1 a.m, the team goes in through the skylight of the lab.
Yeah, this is like a SEAL team, Mission Impossible style operation going on here.
Yeah. They see that the room that they go into, it has the cell attached to it, and the cell door is open and empty. It says, "The discovery and proper use of the thumb bolt might not have happened once in 50 years, if my theory is correct."
So somehow the thing escaped from this room.
Yeah.
And it didn't just do it. I mean, it did it almost accidentally. It messed with the thumb bolt the right way and accidentally opened the door.
Right.
And this accident happened just at the moment that they entered the house, apparently, as well. So a little too much coincidence for my taste.
Or maybe the implication was that it wasn't an accident, that somehow this thing actually does have some intelligence.
Possibly.
They hear some noises from further inside the house. The woman has different rooms than her husband that she stays in, and the noise came from her part of the house. She heard something and then ran out of her bedroom into the hall. She tripped on the something that's on the floor, something that's hissing and rasping and gurgling. The thing on the floor had human arms, strong human arms, and they grab her and strangle her. This commotion woke up the old man, and he ran from his room.
It seemed like also the thing is in some kind of liquid form. I mean, what is this all about? She tripped upon an unseen object on the floor. She fell headlong upon it, encountering in it a large, soft, warm substance that writhed and squirmed, and from which came the sounds that had awakened her.
I just assumed that the thing was crawling around on the floor. Basically, the headless dude was crawling around on the floor because he ain't got no head, so...
But what's with the wetness and the liquidity of it?
I don't know.
This is when it gets kind of cool, because there's something we don't see that is never described about this thing.
Yeah.
It's altered in some way that's really strange. The most horrific part of this section here, and I guess it was teased out in the opening paragraph when they said he mistreated his wife, but it says, "The surgeon," you know, I mean, he apparently knew this day would come. He says, "It has come at last," springing from his bed. So I guess protecting his wife was never a priority for him, even though he seems upset right now. So he takes off down the hall to see what's become of her. By the way, the 4 police who have illegally entered the house, they just kind of trail behind him.
Yeah.
They no attempts to save the wife, see what's happened. They just go, "Hey, let's see what happens. This might be cool."
They might have had a warrant. You don't know.
I don't know if they illegally entered or not. That's true. But I do know they're being very ineffective in this scene. They're just hanging out. Maybe we'll get a little show. But okay, so as he runs towards his wife, He goes, wife, which maybe he doesn't even know her name. That's how bad the relationship is. But he runs. It says he ran past a huge shapeless object, sprawling, crawling, and floundering along, and arrived at the body of his wife. He sees that she's dead and she's all mad about it. So he comes after this thing.
Clutching the knife firmly and holding the lamp aloft, he sprang toward the ungainly object in the corridor. It was then that the officers, still advancing cautiously, saw a little more clearly, though still indistinctly, the object of the surgeon's fury and the cause of the look of unutterable anguish in his face. The hideous sight caused them to pause. They saw what appeared to be a man, yet evidently was not a man. Huge, awkward, shapeless, a squirming, lurching, stumbling mass, completely naked. It raised its broad shoulders. It had no head, but instead of it, a small metallic ball surmounting its massive neck.
Whoa, he's got a metal ball head.
Yeah, I did not see that coming.
I guess his body isn't quite human anymore. I didn't really follow what was happening up to this point. When when he showed up with a metal ball head, man, I just burst out laughing. That was amazing.
I thought it was creepy. It's disturbing. And the fact that he's, whatever physical transformation has happened because the lack of his cerebrum, it's made his body all weird. So it's not just muscly. It's just like a pile of flesh, I guess.
Well, the surgeon's really mad about everything, he says.
Then, with a look of redoubled fury, he sent the knife to the hilt into the squirming mass before him. The wounded monster sprang to its feet and wildly threw its arms about, meanwhile emitting fearful sounds from a silver tube through which it breathed. The surgeon aimed another blow, but never gave it. In his blind fury, he lost his caution and was caught in an iron grasp. The struggling threw the lamp some feet towards the officers, and it fell to the floor, shattered to pieces. Simultaneously with the crash, the oil took fire, and the corridor was filled with flame. The officers could not approach. Before them was the spreading blaze, and secure behind it were two forms, struggling in a fearful embrace. They heard cries and gasps, and saw the gleaming of a knife. The wood in the house was old and dry. It took fire at once, and the flames spread with great rapidity. The four officers turned and fled, barely escaping with their lives. In an hour, nothing remained of the mysterious old house and its inmates but a blackened ruin.
Absolute B-movie ending as well. The two guys struggling in the fire together, whole place goes up, yeah. Sky full of smoke. I'll say this, Morrow has definitely created a unique monster in this story.
Yeah.
He's not reanimated. He's no. Just got a metal ball for a head, and his body's kind of weird to the point where he doesn't look good naked. I don't think anything past that. But still, flabby dude, metal ball head, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good. I always liked that one.
I think if it had better title, this could have ended up being a staple monster.
Uh-huh.
That and probably it would be difficult to sell a cereal. Nobody's going to buy Man with a Metal Ball for a Head Crunch. Even if you make it organic, it's just not going to come off the shelves. So I think it needed something that sang, you know, even though Frankenstein tells you nothing about the novel.
Yeah.
Why is that name so perfect for it? Why? What is it about it? There's something about the title that's great. I think the story needed that.
You know, I said at the top of the show that this story had a connection to Lovecraft. He actually mentioned this story specifically in his Commonplace book.
Really?
Entry number 152. Autonomic nervous system and subconscious mind do not reside in the head. Have mad scientists decapitate a man, but keep him alive and subconsciously controlled. Avoid copying tale by W.C. Morrow.
He did not take the metal ball for a head thing.
No.
Just too bad. Although he could have easily just changed it a little bit so that he could have kept that, you know. Maybe I'll give him a metal cube for a head. Yes, and then I'll have avoid copying this tale.
I don't know if I'm actually curious to read any more W.C. Morrow.
Oh, I don't know. I kind of am. This had some good... I mean, I had fun with it, definitely, even if I was being pretty critical. It had that good B-movie fun.
It did.
And seeing the guy run around with the little sphere on his head is hilarious. I'd like a sequel to this movie. I mean, do you get to switch that sphere out? Could you put, like, a snow globe in there or
yeah.
a cool wizard scepter thing.
Oh, right. Or one of those static electricity generator.
There you go. The Tesla thing. Yeah, exactly. Any of that stuff. Look a little like Mysterio.
That would be great.
Wait a minute. Actually, is it Mysterio? Mysterio's kind of looks just like what this guy might look like, minus the costume.
Well, yeah, Mysterio's had a human head in his sphere.
He does?
Yeah, he does.
There's a head in there? It's not just a... I thought it was just a crystal ball rotating.
He's just a guy that does trickery, illusion. I think it was like a glass sphere full of smoke. So you,
yeah.
His identity was obscured, but he could see out of it.
Thanks for ending the show on a downer by ruining Mysterio for me.
I ruin things again. It's just what I do.
Next month for May, I'm not quite sure what we're doing yet. We still need to figure it out. I do know this. It's going to be awesome.
Oh my God. It's going to kick so much ass.
It's going to blow your mind. Once you don't have a mind, you might consider getting a metal ball to replace it because it'll be so blown. I'm stretching it. Hey, I just want to thank our reader one more time, Jeff C. Carter.
He is probably the best Jeff C. Carter ever.
That's my opinion.
Mine too.
And I agree with myself and you. So it's done. Thank you, Jeff. Make sure to go check out his work at Great Jones Street. Once again, we will link out to it in the show notes. That's it for this week. I am Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lack, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.